to the fourth episode of Nightmares of a Doctor. In order to maintain the anonymity of the individuals concerned in these stories, names, places, and identifying features have been altered where appropriate. Therefore, any resemblance to individuals living or dead is purely coincidental. Although necessary details have been changed, these stories are based on actual events. They are real tragedies suffered by real people in real hospitals and clinics throughout England and Wales. An early skill that any trainee doctor must develop is an understanding of how you can physically harm a patient in order to help them. From inserting a cannula required to deliver fluids, an injection for medication, or even tissue dissection in the sterility of an operating theatre, the act of slicing and cutting into another human being requires some psychological acclimatization. At first, there is an instinctive voice in the back of your head, screaming at you to put down the trembling scalpel that's clasped in your hand. In time, that voice is overcome by another, which reassures you of your purpose and urges you on to overcome the fear and push through the skin, allowing you to perform this basic duty as a doctor. When working in any accident and emergency department, gunshot and stab wounds are a frequent presentation and represent another aspect of patient harm that takes some getting used to. The first time I peered into a life-threatening stab wound, I was distracted by the violence that must have caused that gaping injury. This was not the result of some indifferent disease process or tragic roadside accident. This was something caused by a malicious intent that contradicts all the lessons that our societies, religions, and caregivers aim to teach us. This embodiment of death spoke loudly of an instinct that most of us never see, and yet all are aware of. It represents the cruelest and most savage of human behaviors, born out of pain itself and of utmost mental pressure. It is the instinct in all of us that makes us capable of murder. Gus and Tommy were two young men in their early 20s who grew up together as inseparable best friends. Throughout their young lives, they shared everything together, whether it was money, girlfriends, or even their first taste of crime. But despite their sincere devotion to one another, there was still one thing capable of breaking them apart. The two were born and raised in the shadow of the Black Mountains, a group of old red sandstone hills that make up the easternmost range of the Brecon Beacons in southeast Wales. It's said that the Black Mountains were named by the Saxons, who would gaze upon their dark outlines from the eastern side of the River Wye. When seen from afar, the shadows they cast were long and foreboding. But when approached closely, the Black Mountains can reveal a rainbow of colours. From the spectrum of greens in the sharp summer sunlight, purple in the late summer, then russet in the late autumn when the bracken is dying. Finally, in the winter months, they gleam a brilliant white when the cold wraps around them and leaves them capped with snow. These spectacular peaks form a natural border with Herefordshire, England's western county, and its striking landscapes and winding valleys remain a constant draw to climbers and hikers who regularly come to enjoy this area of outstanding natural beauty. While this rare spot of genuine British wilderness might have impressed some, as two boisterous teenagers, Gus and Tommy were blind to such beauties, preferring instead to finding themselves trouble. Amongst the network of villages and towns that were scattered throughout the valleys, teenagers Gus and Tommy sniffed out something resembling a criminal underworld. Through their associations with petty criminals and rustic drug dealers, they began experimenting with alcohol and marijuana. What might have been perceived as a benign teenage curiosity quickly escalated into ecstasy and cocaine. Soon their experimentations spiraled into the routine, and the two young men graduated as drug dealers. By the age of 17, Gus stood at 6'2", with strong, broad shoulders and long, grasping arms. His imposing physique was matched by his demeanor. His ability to intimidate his peers and elders alike allowed him to develop his propensity for violence. By the time he was 20, Gus could boast of a catalogue of criminal convictions. This included assault for shattering a pint glass across a barman's face, whose only offence was to refuse selling him alcohol. He was also guilty of racially aggravated assault for the beating of a father of a neighbouring black family, who Gus took pleasure from regularly terrorising. For that, Gus served time in prison. But by the time he was released, the family had moved on, while Gus rested freely, considering his conviction as a job well done. Tommy, by comparison, was shorter than Gus and more slightly built, but what he lacked in brawn, he carried in cunning. With Gus at his side when he wasn't serving time, Tommy showed a misplaced aptitude for the business development of their drug-dealing partnership. Under Tommy's direction, the two moved together to the nearby town of Llandrindod Wells to set up camp in the home of one of their more regular clients, a 22-year-old girl called Chloe. They used her home as a base from which to expand their operations and advance their business with the real moneymakers, crack cocaine and heroin. Chloe had spent her life in that two-bed apartment that she had shared with her recently deceased mother. Chloe's mother had suffered from multiple sclerosis, a progressive and disabling neurological condition. In her terminal illness, she had been totally reliant on Chloe for her care. When Chloe's mother died, Chloe had found herself alone in the world, with no other living family, and a life that had been devoted to the care of her mother and best friend. To help her with her grief, she attended a nearby support group for other young adults, which is where she had the misfortune of meeting Gus and Tommy. As part of his probation service, Gus had agreed to attend this support group to help him cope with his anger and various addictions. Tommy, meanwhile, had recognized the potential of these gatherings of vulnerable young adults and had encouraged Gus to network for likely clients. Amongst all the pain and all the misery, Chloe was impressed by Gus's raw masculine presence and strength of personality. Gus was only drawn to her intense vulnerability. It didn't take long for Chloe to fall deeply under Gus and Tommy's spell, who both saw the value of this impressionable young homeowner. All the endeavor and care with which she had once served her mother quickly became channeled into providing accommodation for Tommy and Gus. Chloe leapt at the opportunity to look after these ambitious young men, who she perceived as bringing her purpose and protection. Gus and Tommy came and went from Chloe's property as if it were their own. In time, Chloe developed an emotional and sexual relationship with Gus, solidifying her reliance on the two men entirely, while also legitimizing their intrusion in her home. It was at this time that Gus became involved in a drug-related dispute. A rival drug dealer had been selling in a district that Gus and Tommy had considered their occupied territory. When their threats went ignored, Gus tracked down the rival and confronted him in the street. He broke the rival's nose and arm and shattered several ribs. Gus robbed the man of what he had, then left him for dead. This latest act of savagery was to earn Gus further time in prison. With Gus behind bars, the streets were undoubtedly a safer place to be. But there was at least one person to keenly miss his presence. To Chloe, Gus had been an escape from her grief and a release from her isolation. But with Gus now gone, she became increasingly lost amongst the various drugs that now pervaded her home. She now only saw Tommy and the work that he gave her. Tommy, ever the opportunist, saw a further use for Chloe. And in Gus's absence, he began something with Chloe that resembled a relationship. But it didn't take long before Gus had served his time to return to society and make an unwelcome return back into Tommy and Chloe's lives. This time he left prison with the swagger of a victor, one who had served a just cause in defeating his enemies. Tommy, as was expected of him, had organized a gathering of friends and close family to celebrate Gus's release. Unsurprisingly, he had no such plan to discuss the rapid progression of his relationship with Chloe. When amongst their friends at the pub they had gathered at, Chloe had no option but to reciprocate Gus's numerous tactile displays of affection. Tommy had no choice but to look on at them coolly. As the evening wore on, Chloe found herself torn between Gus's amorous enthusiasm and Tommy's pointed stare. So she stood to disentangle herself from the table of drinkers. But Gus was having fun, and he was in no mood to being ignored. He grabbed the tail of Chloe's trailing brown hair, gripped it tightly, and yanked her back into her seat. The pleasant pub scene was disturbed by her scream and the resulting spilt drinks. Discontent murmurings simmered around the table, but it was the witnessing barman who insisted that Gus leave. Gus rose from the table and greedily confronted the offending barman, but Tommy was quick to mediate the rising confrontation and firmly returned Gus back to the table. In the time it had taken for Tommy to persuade the barman at the harmlessness of the situation, Chloe had collected her belongings and left. Gus did not have the wit to see the connection that existed between Tommy and Chloe, but he did have a firm and easy grasp of jealousy and several pints of beer swilling around his belly. For once, Gus's blind fury stumbled upon reality, and he was quick to accuse Tommy of cheating on him with Chloe. Even Tommy's usual quick thinking couldn't save him from that frank and accurate accusation. It took several of the onlookers to pull Gus away from Tommy and pin the former to the ground. The pub had security who were quick on the scene, and they restrained Tommy securely before calling the police. The implications of involving the police were disastrous for Gus so soon out of prison. The gathering looked to Tommy for the guile or diplomacy required to save his friend, but already he had left, leaving Gus on his own. Tommy returned home quickly and found Chloe there. It was at this time that Tommy's phone rang in alert. The bouncers couldn't hold him, the message read on his phone. Tommy's phone then lit up a second time. The text contained a simple message, a single word written in three capital letters. Run. Tommy calculated the distance to the pub and quickly dismissed the possibility of running. Gus would already be close, so Tommy would try his chances and stay where he was. He summoned Chloe's help, and together they dragged a heavy sofa to block the front door. Tommy locked the door shut and considered his next move. There was no sound of footsteps, just the sound of a light rain falling gently in the street. But it didn't take long before another sound was heard. It was the sound of a key, slowly and deliberately being slid into the keyhole. As it entered the keyhole, its noises were silenced. It came out and then in again, in slow repetition, until suddenly its manipulations became increasingly impatient. Just a few inches away, on the other side of the door, Tommy held his own key firmly in the keyhole, deliberately blocking Gus's key from the outside. There was a pause. From the outside, Gus stared malevolently at the affronting wooden door. He screamed Tommy's name and demanded to be let in. When silence responded, he took a step back and brought his full weight down with a well-aimed kick at the base of the door where it met at the hinges. The force unbalanced Tommy, knocking him to the floor. Several more of Gus's blows reduced the door to kindling. He threw aside its remains and entered the apartment. Gus marched forward and saw a cowering Tommy retreat away behind Chloe. He strode along the corridor with his eyes fixed on Tommy, but Chloe held fast, staring him down while obstructing his way. She may as well have been a statue made of glass, attempting to stop a train at full speed. Without even breaking his step, Gus struck her hard with the back of his hand. Knocked clear of her feet, she hit the floor heavily, dislocating her jaw as it broke in three places. Tommy knew Gus's strength, and he wept as his fury advanced steadily towards him. He panicked, backing off into the kitchen behind him, before realizing this left him with nowhere else to run. He began pleading with Gus, saying anything he could to soften his temper. But Gus, by now, was blinded by booze and a rising well of rage. Gus chased him through the kitchen before catching him in a corner and wrapping his thick fingers around Tommy's narrow throat. Tommy flailed harmlessly at Gus's face and his eyes. The color in Tommy's face went from bright red to pale blue. His vision began to dim. His hands reached out aimlessly at anything that might help him. His right hand found hope in the shape of an object, and he instinctively lunged it forward in the direction of Gus's head. In the hopelessness of his predicament, it might well have been the last thing he ever did, but the immensity of the pressure around his neck was released. The darkness of his vision reformed into shadows and colors. Now before him was Gus, writhing helplessly on the floor. It took a moment for the image to fully make sense. Gus lay on the floor, screaming. He held the left side of his face, where blood dripped from his ear to his neck. Tommy looked down at the object he still held in his hand. 8 inches of sharpened steel that now dripped with Gus's blood. Gus's screams of fear and pain transformed back into anger. He sprang up from the floor, and in the very same moment, Tommy fell down upon him. Tommy brought the knife down with all the strength that he had. He brought it up and down a further 7 times, every stab aimed at Gus's broad chest. Tommy left the knife stuck deep in Gus's chest. With all 8 inches buried, the black stub of the knife's handle stood grotesquely erect, rooted in the center of Gus's bloody chest. Tommy went to find Chloe, who had retreated upstairs to look for a phone. Her broken face was disfigured, but she had managed the bleeding by holding rags in her mouth. Tommy called for an ambulance before returning to the kitchen, but he returned there to find that Gus's body had vanished. Gus was still alive. He had staggered from the kitchen and out of the house. He howled as he wrenched the knife embedded in his chest. Then he took a few steps before collapsing to the ground. An ambulance came to him in the early hours of morning. Gus was still conscious and breathing by himself, but he had lost a lot of blood. The paramedics gave him oxygen and infused fluids through his veins, while the nearby emergency staff prepared for his arrival. Gus's predicament was about to get worse. The paramedic by Gus's side moved incessantly around him, doing all that she could do to optimize his failing condition. Her colleague at the wheel flew the ambulance along dark country lanes, while simultaneously communicating every update to the nearest emergency department. Over a period of minutes, Gus went from lucid to confused, before becoming totally unresponsive. It was at this point that Gus's heart stopped. The paramedic moved quickly, flattening the bed and beginning chest compressions to replace the contractions of Gus's failing heart. As they arrived in the accident and emergency car park, staff worked all around her to transfer Gus while she maintained compressions throughout the maneuver. The two on-call surgeons who were waiting in the emergency department decoded the situation as Gus was hurried towards them. Cardiac arrest occurring in the context of penetrating chest trauma suggested bleeding in his chest had built a pressure around his heart. When that pressure had exceeded the strength of Gus's heart, all output from it was lost. The doctors would need to release the pressure around his heart, but they knew there wasn't time to take him to the operating theatre. Gus was laid out on a resuscitation bed in the emergency department. The two on-call doctors were joined by the anesthetic doctor, who slipped a tube down Gus's windpipe and squeezed on a bag to ventilate his lungs. One of the nurses took over responsibility for the continuing chest compressions. The two doctors made incisions on each side of Gus's chest, bringing each incision centrally towards Gus's midline. Using heavy scissors, they attempted to cut around the ribs to get through the sternum. When both tried and failed, they called in a burly porter to apply his own strength instead. With a crunch, he dissected the bony part of Gus's sternum. Chest compressions were stopped, and both sides of Gus's chest were levered open like a box, revealing his lungs, which swelled up rhythmically each time the anesthetist squeezed upon the bag. Between the two lungs was Gus's yellow-red heart. It lay there inert in a mass of clotted blood. The surgeons moved quickly to scoop away the blood and shattered bone that had collected throughout the cavity of Gus's wide chest. Then one of them cupped Gus's heart in his hands and gently replicated the pulsatile contractions that it should have been making. Between his two hands, he milked the blood out of the heart and into the arteries. The second doctor used two fingers to compress the descending aorta, the largest arterial vessel delivering oxygenated blood to the abdomen and lower limbs. The doctor's two fingers were like a dam to a river, blocking the blood flow to Gus's lower half, diverting it instead to the brain and to the heart itself, where it was desperately needed in that dire predicament. A coordinated flick was then deliberately given to the tip of Gus's heart. It was just enough. Gus's heart began to shudder, and then it throbbed back to life. While this was certainly good news, it brought with it a new problem. To access Gus's heart, the doctors had cut through two important vessels in the front of Gus's chest. With circulation now restored, they began to bleed. Recognizing the problem quickly, they tied off each artery before they bled any further. The scene was more akin to a mortuary dissection than an A&E resuscitation, but Gus now had a pulse from his tremulous heart, which gave him a semblance of hemodynamic stability. The team was then able to take him to the operating theatre to review the extent of his injuries and repair what they could. The two nighttime doctors were finished in the operating theatre by just after midday. They handed over the case to their day team colleagues before leaving for home for an unsettled sleep. By the time they both had returned for the start of their next night shift, Gus's failing heart had given up once more. He had suffered enough. This time there was nothing that could be done to save his life. Tommy was arrested, and he was tried before a jury of 12 of his peers. It is said that he wept constantly throughout the 11-day trial. Gus had lived and died as a man of violence, but did he deserve so brutal an end, delivered by the man he considered his closest friend? The jury listened closely before deliberating on a decision for just over 3 hours. They returned to deliver a unanimous verdict. For murder and for manslaughter, Tommy was found not guilty. Tommy returned to the remains of the life he had left. When Gus died by his hand, part of Tommy did too. Without Gus at his side, the course of Tommy's future had been irrevocably changed. What path he now takes is his choice to make. These stories deal with themes that will be challenging for some. If you're in need of advice, try to speak to a loved one or someone you trust. If you are still unsure, seek advice from your registered GP, who can refer you on to one of the many available support services. If you or someone you know are dealing with a mental health emergency, you should urgently contact your local crisis support group. Talking costs nothing, but it could be worth everything.